food is energy, and it takes energy to get food. These two facts, when we take them together, have always established the biological limits to the human population. We humans have become champions at developing new strategies for increasing our share of energy captured from the environment. The harnessing of fire, the domestication of plants and animals, the deployment of irrigation schemes, and the harnessing of traction animals, developments that occurred over tens of thousands of years. The process was gradual and time-consuming. Over centuries, small inventions and tiny modifications of existing tools, from scythes to horse collars, enabled human and animal muscle power to be leveraged ever more slightly more effectively. This exercise took place within a network of natural limits. The yearly capture of solar radiation by the green biosphere was immense relative to human needs, but finite nevertheless. And the vast majority of that solar radiation served functions that indirectly supported human existence, giving rise to air currents by warming the surface of the planet and maintaining life in the oceans and on land. The amount of human muscle power was limited by the number of humans, who of course had to be fed, by draft animals, who also entailed energy costs, as they likewise needed to eat. Therefore, even with clever refinements in tools and techniques, in crop development and animal breeding, it was clear that we humans would inevitably reach a point of diminishing returns in our ability to continue increasing our energy harvest, and therefore our population. By the 19th century, these limits were beginning to become apparent. Famine and hunger, as we've already heard, had always been common throughout even the wealthiest regions of the planet. But migration to other nations, crop rotation, and the application of manures and composts were gradually making those events less frequent and severe. European farmers, realizing the need for a nitrogen source in order to continue feeding their burgeoning and increasingly urbanized populations, began employing guano, bird excrement, imported from the cliffs of islands off Chile and Argentina. However, after only a few decades, those guano deposits were being depleted. By this time, in the late 1890s, the world's population was nearly twice what it had been at the beginning of the 19th century. A crisis was again in view. Crisis was narrowly averted due to fossil fuels. In 1909, two German chemists named Fritz Haber and Karl Bosch invented a process to synthesize ammonia from atmospheric nitrogen and the hydrogen in fossil fuels. The process, the Haber-Bosch process, initially used coal as a feedstock, though later it was adapted to use natural gas, which is currently the feedstock of choice. After the end of the Great War, nation after nation began building Haber-Bosch plants. Today, the process produces 150 million tons of ammonia per year, equaling the total amount of available nitrogen produced from all natural sources combined. The Haber-Bosch process has effectively doubled the amount of available nitrogen in the biosphere and concentrated it specifically for the purpose of growing crops for human beings. Fossil fuels went on to offer still other ways of extending natural limits to the human carrying capacity of the planet. Early steam-driven tractors came into limited use in the 19th century, but after World War I, the size and effectiveness of powered farm machinery expanded dramatically, and the scale of use of farm machinery exploded, especially in North America, Europe, and Australia during the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. In the 1890s, one quarter of U.S. cropland had to be set aside for the growing of grain to feed horses, most of which worked on farms. The internal combustion engine provided a new kind of horsepower, of course, and also increased the amount of arable land available to feed humans. Chemical pesticides and herbicides, developed mostly after World War II, used knowledge pioneered in the laboratories that had worked to perfect explosives and other chemical warfare agents. Pesticides not only increased crop yields in, again, Europe, North America, and Australia, but also reduced the prevalence of insect-borne diseases like malaria. the world began to enjoy the benefits of better living through chemistry. Though the environmental costs in terms of water and soil pollution and damage to vulnerable species would only later become widely apparent. In the 1960s, industrial chemical agricultural practices began to be exported, as we've heard, to what by that time was being called the Third World. This was glowingly dubbed the Green Revolution, and it enabled a tripling of food production during the past half century. At the same time, the scale and speed of distribution of food increased. But with advances in transport, the quantities and distances involved gradually increased. Here again, fossil fuels were responsible for a dramatic discontinuity in the slow pace of growth. First by rail and steamship, then by truck and airplane, immense amounts of grain and ever larger quantities of meats, vegetables, and specialty foods began to flow from countryside to city, from region to region, and from continent to continent. Carrying capacity is always limited by whatever necessity is in least supply. If one region has water but no good topsoil, its carrying capacity is limited by the lack of topsoil. Another region may have good soil but insufficient rainfall. There, the carrying capacity is limited by water. From an ecological point of view, this is why people trade. But trade has historically been limited by the amount of energy that could be supplied or applied to the transport of materials. Fossil fuels have temporarily erased that limit. The end result was not just a threefold leap in crop yields, but a similar explosion of human population, which has grown fivefold since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution. All of this would be well and good if it were sustainable. But if it proves not to be, then a temporary exuberance of the human species will have been purchased by an enormous, unprecedented human tragedy. Arable cropland, until recently, was increasing because of the clearing of forests, putting new lands into production and through irrigation. Now the amount of arable cropland globally is decreasing because of salinization of soils, because of urban growth, erosion. Topsoil, created over tens of thousands and millions of years, of course, is decreasing. In the U.S. Great Plains, about half of the original topsoil is gone, much of it washed down the Mississippi River into the Gulf of Mexico. The nutritional quality of our food is actually decreasing on a yearly basis due to the gradual demineralization of the soil. And this has been actually documented through measurements taken by the U.S. Department of Agriculture since the 1940s. The number of farmers as a percentage of the population is, of course, decreasing. In the U.S., at the turn of the last century, something like 70% of the population were directly involved in food production. Today, that number is more like between 1 and 2% of the population. The number of domesticated crop varieties is decreasing dramatically due to the consolidation of the seed industry. Not that many years ago, in Bali, there were 200 varieties of rice, each adapted to a different microclimate of that small island. Now there are only 4 rice varieties being grown in Bali. Of course, the global population, as we've seen, is still growing. We're adding about 80 million people per year currently. We reached 6 billion in 1998, and since 1998, we've added another nearly 500 million, roughly the total size of the population of North America. But for the past decade and a half, population growth has outstripped grain production. So there's actually less available on a per-head basis. Meanwhile, the global climate is, of course, increasingly destabilized, resulting in relatively minor problems for farmers now, but these are problems that are likely to grow to catastrophic proportions just within the next decade or two. Meanwhile, available fresh water is decreasing. In the U.S., 85% of fresh water use goes toward agricultural production, requiring the drawing down of ancient aquifers at far above their recharge rates. Globally, as water tables fall, ever more powerful pumps must be used to lift irrigation water. By 2020, according to World Watch Institute and the UN, virtually every country in the world will face shortages of fresh water. Oil production is peaking. That, of course, makes machinery more expensive to operate as oil prices go up. It makes fertilizers more expensive to produce. And it also makes transportation of food more expensive. And this, I believe, may be the single factor that brings all of these other problems to a full boil. The state of dependency on fossil fuels has become enormous. In the U.S., agriculture is responsible for well over 10% of all national energy consumption. Over 400 gallons of oil equivalent are expended to feed each American each year. Trucks move most of the world's food, even though trucking is 10 times more energy intensive than moving food by train or barge. Refrigerated jets move a small but growing proportion of food, almost entirely, of course, to wealthy industrial nations, at 60 times the energy cost of sea transport. Processed foods make up 3/4 of global food sales by price, though not by quantity. This adds dramatically to energy costs. For example, a 1-pound box of breakfast cereal may require over 7,000 kilocalories of energy, while the cereal itself provides only 1,100 kilocalories of food energy. Within this debate, two viewpoints have emerged. The first advocates further intensification of industrial food production, primarily via the genetic engineering of new crop and animal varieties. The second advocates ecological agriculture in its various forms, organic, biodynamic, permaculture, biointensive, and other methods. Critics of the latter course contend that traditional chemical-free forms of agriculture are incapable of feeding the burgeoning human population. If crops are rotated and the soil is fertilized with compost, animal manure, and sewage, thereby returning as much fixed nitrogen as possible to the soil, it is just possible for a hectare of land to feed 10 people, provided they accept a mainly vegetarian diet. Although such farming is almost sustainable, it falls short of the productivity of land that is fertilized with artificial nitrogen. This can easily support 40 people and on a varied diet. But given the fact that fossil fuels are non-renewable, it will be increasingly difficult to continue supplying chemical fertilizers in present quantities. Nitrogen can be synthesized using hydrogen produced from electrolysis of water with solar or wind power as a source of electricity. But currently, no ammonia is being commercially produced this way because of the uncompetitive cost of doing so. The bioengineering of crop and animal varieties does little or nothing to solve this problem. Size about maize or other crops modified to fix nitrogen in the way that legumes do, but so far efforts in that direction have failed. Meanwhile, the genetic engineering of complex life forms appears to pose unprecedented environmental and human health hazards, and the bioengineering industry itself consumes fossil fuels and assumes the continued availability of oil for tractors, transportation, chemical production, and so on. Those arguing in favor of small-scale ecological agriculture tend to be very optimistic about its ability to support large populations. For example, the 2002 Greenpeace study, The Real Green Revolution, Organic and Agroecological Farming in the South, quote, "In general, it's thought that organic and agroecological farming can bring significant increases in yields in comparison to conventional farming practices." Eco-agricultural advocates contend that there is plenty of food in the world. Existing instances of hunger are due merely to bad policy and poor distribution. With better policy and better distribution, all could easily be fed well into the future. Given the universally admitted harmful environmental consequences of conventional chemical farming, the choice should be simple. Eco-ag proponents suggest that permaculture, biointensive, or biodynamic methods can produce far higher yields than can mechanized chemical-based agriculture. Experiments have indeed shown that small-scale, biodiverse gardening can be more productive on a per-hectare basis than monocropped megafarms. However, some of these studies tend to ignore the energy and land productivity costs of manures and composts imported onto the study plots. Permaculture and biointensive forms of agriculture are dramatically more labor and knowledge intensive than industrial agriculture. The adoption of these methods will require an economic transformation of societies. Even if the nitrogen problem can be solved in principle by agroecological methods and or hydrogen production from renewable energy sources, there may be a carrying capacity bottleneck ahead simply because of the inability of societies to adapt to these very different energy and economic needs quickly enough. Even though it may not be politically correct in many circles to discuss the population problem, we must recognize that we are nearing or past fundamental natural limits, no matter which course we pursue. According to widely accepted calculations, humans are presently appropriating about 40% of Earth's primary biological productivity. We must return to a food system that is less fossil fuel reliant, even if it does prove to be less productive. Cuba, back in the 1980s, was more reliant on fossil fuels for agricultural production than even the United States. And so the collapse of the Soviet Union at the end of the 1980s was a catastrophe for Cuba. Their oil use was reduced by over 50%. At that time, the Soviet Union, which was the world's first or second foremost oil-producing nation, was exporting oil to Cuba at such a discount that the Cubans were actually re-exporting some of that oil for a profit to earn foreign exchange income. In 1991, Soviet personnel left Cuba. Economic subsidies to something like $6 billion a year vanished. The GDP collapsed by 85% in the first 2 years. As a result of all of this, the Cuban people suffered. They lost weight, on average, 20 pounds per person. There was, of course, a major decrease in the material standard of living. So what did Cuba do during what they came to call the special period? At that time, there had been some Cuban organic agronomists who had been advocating for the adoption of more organic agricultural methods within Cuba. Once the fossil fuels became much more expensive, weren't available, these organic agronomists were called in and basically given free rein to redesign Cuba's agricultural system. They abandoned the Soviet industrial model of agriculture. They broke up the large state-owned farms into smaller private plots and co-op farms. They basically went organic because they had to, because they didn't have the chemical fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides. Meanwhile, they maintained their free, decentralized medical system and used their limited oil resources to generate electricity because electricity was more important. That was providing the absolute necessities of their minimally industrialized way of life. They had to save fossil fuels wherever they could, so they de-emphasized the private automobile. And they began moving people around by ox cart and in these giant vehicles that they call the camel, which is basically a tractor trailer rig in which they cram about 300 people in the trailer. Traffic cops now would stop any car on the road that had empty seats and make it wait until enough hitchhikers showed up to fill up the car. As a result of all of this, the Cuban society did survive. The economy, as of 2005, is growing again steadily, but at a very slow rate. Food production is up to about 90% of the pre-crisis period. There's been very little new housing, mostly remodeling of existing housing structures. That fact is mostly due to the high energy cost of cement. Transportation is still at very much an ad hoc, improvised basis. Everybody shares every vehicle on the road. Cubans adopted a mostly vegetarian diet, but they did so involuntarily. There wasn't much meat to go around because meat production required more energy. Meat eating went from twice a day to twice a week. Of course, therefore, they needed to supplement their diets with more vegetable sources of protein, They decreased their consumption of wheat and rice. With less transportation, they had to move producers and consumers closer together. So this meant more urban gardening, encouraging the growth of gardens all throughout the cities like Havana. Any kind of empty land was immediately put into agricultural production, and rooftop gardening was adopted. Rural areas improved their education for farmers. Many people moved from Havana to the country. In order for this to happen, they had to raise salaries for farmers above the salaries being offered for office workers in the cities. As a result of all of this, of course, there's very little obesity now in Cuba due to the healthier diet and more physical work. The Cuban response to energy famine and how this may offer us lessons for how to deal with the coming energy famine in the rest of the industrialized world. They found usefulness for raised beds, which help with hand labor. These raised beds can be built over existing pavement, as on parking lots and even city streets. Immediately, they began breeding more oxen in Cuba because they realized that oxen would be necessary. And of course, horses tend to compete with people for grain. Rooftop gardening, very widespread throughout Havana and the other cities, but also rooftop raising of food animals like chickens, hamsters, and rabbits. The transition to a non-fossil fuel system will take time. The Cubans took 15 years to arrive at where they are now. Every aspect of the process by which we feed ourselves has to be rethought. This transition must occur at a rapid pace, backed by the full resources of national governments. Without cheap transportation fuels, we will have to reduce the amount of food transportation that occurs and make necessary transportation much more efficient. This implies increased local food self-sufficiency. Think of places like Las Vegas, Nevada, or even Los Angeles, California. How much food can be grown in those places? We will need to grow more food in and around cities, certainly. Currently, Oakland, California is debating a food policy initiative that would mandate the growing of 40% of the vegetables consumed in the city within 50 miles of city center by 2015. If the example of Cuba were followed, rooftop gardens would result, as well as rooftop raising of food animals, as we saw. Localization of the food process means moving producers and consumers of food closer together, but it also means relying on the local manufacturing and regeneration of all the elements of the production process, from seeds to tools and farm machinery. This would appear to rule out agricultural bioengineering, which favors the centralized production of patented seed varieties and discourages the free saving of seeds from year to year by farmers. Clearly, we must minimize chemical inputs to agriculture, both direct and indirect, such as those introduced in processing of foods. We will need to reintroduce draft animals in agricultural production. And as the Cubans found, oxen may in many instances be preferable to horses. Governments must also provide incentives for people to return to an agricultural life. I think it would be a mistake simply to think in terms of the need for a larger agricultural workforce. Traditional agriculture requires social networks, intergenerational trust and bonding and knowledge sharing. We need not just more workers, but a rural culture. Farming requires knowledge and experience, and so we will need education for a new generation of farmers. It will be necessary as well to break up the corporate mega farms that produce so much of today's cheap grain. Industrial agriculture implies an economy of scale that is utterly inappropriate and unworkable for post-industrial food systems. Thus, land reform will be required in order to enable smallholders and farming co-ops to own their own plots. In order for all of this to happen, governments must end subsidies to industrial agriculture and begin subsidizing post-industrial agricultural efforts. The present regime of subsidies is so harmful that merely stopping it in its tracks and doing nothing else would itself be advantageous. The offering of subsidies for education, low-interest loans for land purchase, and support during the transition from chemical to organic production would be essential. Given the carrying capacity limits, food policy must include population policy. We must encourage smaller families by means of economic incentives, and we must improve the economic and educational status of women in poorer countries around the world. attempting to solve the problem simply by applying more technological intensification will certainly result in dire consequences. In that case, existing farmers would fail because of fuel and chemical prices. All of the worrisome existing trends mentioned earlier would intensify to the point that the human carrying capacity of Earth would be degraded significantly and perhaps to a very large degree permanently. In sum, the transition to a fossil fuel-free food system doesn't constitute a utopian proposal. In the end, it is the only rational option for averting human tragedy on a scale never before seen. I think a very important consideration for the poorer countries, because there you have millions of people who are aspiring to the industrialized urban way of life. For example, the townships in South Africa. You don't see gardens there in the townships. Here are people living in extreme poverty, and they could certainly benefit by growing a few tomatoes or potatoes or something, but they don't do that because they associate growing food, growing your own food, with poverty. That's where they came from. And they want to move into the urban existence of Cape Town and Johannesburg and be like the folks who own cars and so on. So that, I think that perception has to change. I think for people who are don't even understand the problem of peak oil, for instance, that just bringing them that information is about as much as their brains can contain at one moment. And it's really only after one has absorbed that and a few other worrisome facts about the unsustainability of our modern industrial society that one can begin to really talk about the full consequences. It's more than the average person can absorb all at once. But for policymakers, these people have to understand this, because even if it's very difficult, just from a human standpoint, to absorb the news, these people are responsible, after all, for making the kinds of decisions that will determine life and death for perhaps millions of people. They have to be made to understand it. There's a great deal we've learned during the industrial period about things that can be produced and ways of producing them. We will be able to adapt, but we're simply going to have a lot less energy with which to pursue the productive process. And that's going to mean, if you look at what industrialization has been and what it has meant, we will have less of it. So you can call it anything you want, but it's going to be coming down off that peak of mechanization of the human experience and the human relationship with nature. Demechanization, if you will. I'm not sure I can think of a way to make it seem like a overwhelmingly attractive idea to people who are already overwhelmingly invested in a very elaborate, well-funded, inexpensive in terms of food production per minute's work to be able to buy a tomato or whatever. What we desperately need to understand is that we can't continue that. I think your Minister of Agriculture needs to understand the problem of peak oil. It would be nice if we could advertise the transition to a fossil fuel-free agriculture as being easier and cheaper and so on. And it is more rewarding in many respects. And there are advantages, but purely on that basis, I don't think the transition will occur. What we really have to understand is the chemical-based industrial agriculture simply cannot be continued because of the problem of peak oil. And the longer we wait to address that problem, the more likely it is that we will face this carrying capacity bottleneck. We have a responsibility to anticipate this problem, because even U.S. Department of Energy, the report prepared for the U.S. Department of Energy, is acknowledging that this problem is inevitable. There should be no controversy about that. There may be a little controversy about when it's going to occur, but there should be no controversy that the event will occur. So we have to prepare for it. That message has to get across.